You're listening to the Primary Medicine Podcast with Kevin and Dimitri, bringing you the best in primary care CME that you can use in your everyday practice.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Primary Medicine Podcast. I have a very special guest today, Dr. Megha Poddar. She's an endocrinologist and obesity medicine specialist in Toronto, Ontario. She's a diplomat of the American Board of Obesity Medicine and assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at McMaster University. Dr. Poddar serves as the medical director of the Medical Weight Management Center of Canada and the clinical director of the LMC Weight Management Program. As a lead author and co-author, she has contributed to various resources on obesity education, including the McMaster Textbook of Internal Medicine and the 2020 Canadian Adult Obesity Clinical Practice Guidelines, which is great because I have a lot of questions. She's dedicated to mentoring healthcare providers in obesity management and clinical development, both nationally and globally, and a passionate advocate for patients living with obesity. Thank you so much for joining us. It's such a pleasure.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
So I want to start off by talking about the guidelines that you helped co-author, which were published in 2020. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
And I want to focus a bit on the therapy, because my understanding is generally there was three categories of therapy that you're talking about. You had the physiological and behavioral interventions, you had the pharmacotherapy, and then you had the surgical therapy. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of the gist of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the way to sort of best describe the treatment chapter is before what the guidelines used to say is this classic pyramid where lifestyle modification was at the bottom, then it was medication, then it was surgery at the very top or the tip of the pyramid. And we've really moved away from that model because it made people believe that you have to do one, fail at it, then do the other thing, fail at that, and then go to the top. We know that that stepwise approach in any chronic disease treatment doesn't actually work. Why the guidelines changed their structure of the algorithm, it now looks like a house. So the roof of the house is medical nutritional therapy. You'll note we've moved away from the word diet, right? Because it just sort of implicates this whole idea of just eat less and exercise more. And we know that obesity is more complicated than that. So the roof of the house is medical nutritional therapy and physical activity. We understand that is necessary for everyone. It doesn't matter how much you weigh. It doesn't matter whether you're getting treatment for obesity or not. It doesn't matter if you're a child or an elderly patient. That is recommended across the board. But that is not actually true treatment for obesity. And we can kind of talk about obesity as a chronic disease and why treatment is now defined differently. But the pillars of the house are the things that allow you to engage in medical nutritional therapy and physical exercise. So what is treatment doing? It's allowing you to eat better and be more active. And those treatments are psychological intervention and behavioral therapy. That's like why we eat. It's not what we eat, how many calories, what macronutrient. It's what drives my relationship with food. Why do I get cravings? Why do I stress eat? Unless we start to understand those pieces, it's very difficult to actually do medical nutritional therapy. Pharmacotherapy is medications, also typically centered around appetite. Again, how do I stick with a diet if I'm more hungry when I calorie restrict? That's where medications start to play a bigger role. And same thing with bariatric surgery. So those three pillars are the actual treatments for obesity. They hold up the house, which is the behavior changes that you need to do, changing your nutrition and being more active.
You know, that's such a great way to sort of, because we're still stuck in a paradigm of you escalate. You know, yeah. When you have arthritis, you start with exercise and you're out of medication, then you do surgery. And a lot of people think in the same way as obesity, but I love the fact that you're asking the question, why do you eat? Because mm-hmm. the answer is different for different people. And for some people, they eat because of stress. Right. So diet is not the answer there, right? You have to manage the stress somehow. Do you think, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's a really unfortunate journey that people go through when they struggle with weight. Because so often they're being told, well, just eat less food. And it's so difficult to actually navigate help when all you're being all you're doing is telling somebody to just eat less calories. If you don't understand why I'm craving food in the first place, I'm never going to actually successfully be able to consume less. So there is value in understanding like the root cause of the eating behavior and not just blanketly saying you know, eat less calories, do a food diary, that kind of thing.
No, I had the pleasure of talking to a bariatric surgery patient who was very wise about her journey. Mm-hmm. And she actually told me something interesting. She said, you know what I realized? That the feeling I had that made me think I was hungry was actually anxiety. Like mm-hmm. my feelings of anxiety to me back then, before I realized what they were I was translating as hunger.
Right.
But now I know hunger and I know anxiety. I know how to manage both. Obviously, if I'm hungry, I need energy. Right. I'll eat.
Right.
Have anxiety. I was like, this is so wise. And it sort of changed my paradigm as well. And I'm glad to see that you've incorporated this. But do you think that message has gone through? Because, I mean, I see what you're saying. And I really agree with it. But like, I was still stuck with the idea you start here and then you move on mm-hmm. to surgery, then you do pharmacotherapy. Do you think you're getting through to people with this change?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you're talking to somebody who kind of lives and breathes in this space. So I'd love to, you know, my hope is that we are getting somewhere. The Canadian Clinical Practice Guidelines were the most read article ever for the CMAJ. So it is making moves. People are paying attention because I think that we understand that every single patient that we're seeing is struggling with something related to weight, whether they're gaining weight or dealing with a comorbidity related to weight. So this is happening in our offices to our family members, to potentially us, to our patients. So it's not a conversation that's going away. I do think people are interested to learn more. I also like the clinical practice guidelines. Canada's the global leader. A lot of people don't realize this, but Chile and Ireland have actually adapted our guidelines. So never before have countries said, you know what, we're just going to use your guidelines. They make their own. They create their own scientific committee. But they've actually adapted our guidelines because we took it in a totally different approach. We had patients at the table. So if you read the guidelines, you'll see that there is patient messaging. How do I advocate for myself? How do I talk to my doctor about this? Right in the guidelines. That was never the case before. Every single chapter talks about stigma and bias because of that reason that you just said. At the end of the day, patients are advocating for themselves and they're empowered because they are sort of reading these guidelines or talking on social media or just sort of feeling like they deserve treatment and they're coming to us. And so now it's like the patient's job or the patients are coming to us and the physicians are kind of behind or the healthcare providers are feeling like I need to catch up because people are asking me about this. And medications have changed the conversation tremendously. We can talk about the pros and cons of how that conversation has gone. But at the end of the day, you know, we're the ones that are going to be helping these patients with these challenges. And so a lot of healthcare providers want to help their patients. And so they want to learn more about it. And, you know, I do think that the conversation is changing. We have a long way to go because bias is inherent in the healthcare system. It's at the medical school level. It's at the clinic level. Like, it's there and it's pervasive and it's very difficult to change. But in my experience, patients are actually the ones that are changing the narrative. And it's super cool to see that.
Yeah, it's true. Again and again, people are coming to my office and they're actually starting a conversation because sometimes you have to be careful. You don't want to, when you start a conversation, be very patient-centered and not make them feel bad or guilty. And obviously I always ask permission, but I haven't had to do that a lot. People I want to lose weight. What can we do?
Exactly.
So I've noticed some of that actually. And I guess we're behind. That's why I have you here. Cause I just want to go through all these questions. I mean, obviously, the drugs have changed. Obviously, it sounds like finally we have something that works. If be frank with you, mm-hmm. I've started practicing medicine about 12 years ago. And what do we have back then? Orlistat? Nobody took that, right? Yeah. People took it for 3 months and then they gave up. And finally, we have something that does the job. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about that.
Okay.
Let's talk about pharmacotherapy here. Now, just to understand what the guidelines say, and again, I like the idea of a house, but generally pharmacotherapy should be considered in people who have a BMI over 30.
Correct.
Or a BMI over 27 with some complication related to extra visceral fat or obesity. Yeah. Am I correct with that summary?
That's the criteria for sure. Yeah.
Okay. And complications are diabetes, cardiovascular issues. Do you,
metabolic dysfunction.
Dysfunction, mm-hmm. like liver dysfunction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. There's actually no limit in terms of like these specific criteria are needed for medication in the same way they are for surgery. So right, with surgery, right. There are specific comorbidities because surgery actually improves those specific comorbidities better than other interventions. Whereas with medications, it's any comorbidity that your weight is implicated in, mental health, mechanical health, metabolic health, anything can be actually used as a comorbidity.
I have a bit of a maybe controversial question about that, because mm-hmm. there is some talk about the risks of increases of cancer with yep. obesity. Is that somehow would that be a consideration in giving somebody medication if they're high risk for cancer? Has that been discussed with the committee, just the cancer risk? Is this something to really think about?
It is it's an interesting question. I think we're early in the conversation around, does obesity treatment improve cancer risk? Because as the data suggests, at this point in time, really only bariatric surgery has ever been shown to do that. Now, our medical treatments are far more effective than they ever were before. So if you're losing 5 to 10% of your body weight, we're probably not going to see malignancy-related outcomes that are going to be beneficial, which is what we were getting with older medication therapies. Now we're seeing 15, 20, 25% weight loss, very similar to bariatric surgery weight loss. And now we're actually looking at malignancy risk with those medications that are greater in efficacy. So I think it's, we'll put a pin in it, because I think the question is being studied. And right now we can't confidently say that treating with medications for obesity will actually improve your cancer risk.
It's going to take time. It's being looked at, but I'm glad to know that it's being looked at, because I was interested mm-hmm. in that. So let's go back. So let's say we have a patient who fits the criteria, mm-hmm. right? And they've come to my office and they've asked me, Dr. Renev, can I have some Ozempic, right? That's the question I keep getting every day.
You said the O word. It was going to come right. up.
So let's talk a bit about the medication, because obviously the GLP-1s are the class of drugs Ozempic belongs to. But I believe in the guidelines, you don't even mention Ozempic. You're talking about liraglutide, right? Which mm-hmm. is not Ozempic. That's mm-hmm. Saxenda.
Yeah. So let me break it down. So I'll give you a broad overview. Right sure. now, there are four Health Canada approved medications for weight management. Orlistat or Zenical, it's a fat blocker. You take it with meals containing fat. It literally blocks the dietary absorption of fat. That's how it works. That's why it doesn't work very well. The average weight reduction is about 3 to 5% and causes a lot of GI side effects, so we don't use it. The next agent that came to market in 2015 was liraglutide, which is what you're describing. It's a GLP-1 receptor agonist. It's an injectable that you take every day. The name of that medication is called Saxenda. This is the same molecule, liraglutide, that is Victoza, used in diabetes. It's just a higher dose of it. It's an injectable you take every day. It works to regulate appetite. So whenever people with obesity try and reduce their calories, we know that their appetites naturally go up. That's one of the biggest reasons why diets don't work, because you try and eat less and you get more hungry. And so you can't stick with the diet, because physiologically your body's not allowing you to do that. So when you take a GLP-1, you're actually able to reduce your appetite and stick with that calorie reduction longer, because you're not fighting that biological urge to eat more. It also slows down the passage of food through the gut. That allows you to stay full longer. Also very effective for insulin resistance, metabolic complications. That's liraglutide. The next agent that came out in about 2019 was Contrave. This is a tablet that's a combination of naltrexone, which is an anti-opioid medication, and bupropion, which is a common antidepressant. It's a dopamine norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. This works on a totally different area of the brain. It regulates cravings, reward that we get from food, that why we eat, the emotional eating, stress eating. Food noise is how patients describe it. I think about food all the time. I just can't stop thinking about food. I'm not hungry. I just keep thinking about it. It calms that area of the brain, and it works on the reward pleasure seeking piece of food. This is a tablet. It's taken two tablets twice a day. Things that you think about is because it's bupropion or Wellbutrin, interactions with other antidepressants, side effects like headaches, nausea, and insomnia are typically what we talk about. The newest agent that was approved by Health Canada last year was semaglutide or Wegovy. Semaglutide at the dose of 2.4 milligrams per week. And this is the same medication that is in Ozempic. Ozempic is semaglutide 0.4 milligrams or 1 milligram. Ozempic is only approved for type 2 diabetes. So we are technically using Ozempic off-label because the on-label version of this is Wegovy, semaglutide, not yet available in Canada. It's the same drug, same molecule. It's at a lower dose. And so the safety and the efficacy is all sort of being taken from the Wegovy trials. But because we don't have access to that therapy, we're using Ozempic off-label. It's a GLP-1 receptor agonist, just like liraglutide. So all of those things that I talked about, appetite suppression, insulin resistance, delayed gastric emptying is how it works. Wegovy is the most effective tool currently in the toolbox. The average weight reduction is about 15.5 or 16% body weight compared to Saxenda, which is around 8% body weight. So the clinical practice guidelines were actually updated in 2022, just the pharmacotherapy chapter, and they did include semaglutide, 2.4 milligrams or Wegovy in that chapter, but Ozempic's not on there because it's off-label.
Do people use Rybelsus, the oral version, off-label as well for weight loss? Is that something that's being done? I sort of hear rumblings about it.
I get asked this question a lot. I think it's because of multiple reasons. So Rybelsus is the oral version of the same molecule, semaglutide. It's been approved for type 2 diabetes as well. It is not as effective for weight. So the average weight reduction of Rybelsus is about 2 to 3 kilograms, like 50% less than the subcutaneous version. So we don't typically recommend using it off label for weight because it's not very effective. But interestingly, the OASIS 1 trial was just recently published, and that's oral semaglutide at 25 and 50 milligrams. So you're noticing that the diabetes drugs, we're using them in higher doses for obesity. It's the same thing with oral semaglutide. And at the 50 milligram dose, it's actually been shown to be as effective as the subcutaneous. So I think a lot of this chatter around Rybelsus is coming from that trial because it keeps talking about oral semaglutide, but the dosing is much, much, much higher.
Much higher.
And the max dose of Rybelsus is 14 milligrams. Yeah. And because it's a unique molecule, you can't just take like a bunch of the tablets all at once. They actually have to be taken with a small sip of water without food. It's a very carefully sort of absorbed molecule. So you can't actually take two tablets. So it's not my recommendation to use it off label.
Gotcha. So going back, because you mentioned the three treatments, pharmacological treatments, and there's Contrave. So do you, obviously we're going to talk about the weight management program that you're running, but when you have a patient, like if the why of eating is emotional, is anxiety related or craving related, do you start with Contrave or how do you decide which drug to go with initially?
So this is a great question because if you asked me a year and a half ago, you know, I would say that the symptoms of weight would be the way to determine which medication to take. For example, as you described, is this patient like a reward seeker, emotional eater, having low mood, lots of cravings? This sounds more like a Contrave person, as opposed to somebody who has difficulty with portion control, feeling hungry all the time. They feel more like a GLP-1 patient. Now, honestly, the conversation has changed a lot because of efficacy. Because the degree of weight benefit on our newer agents is so much greater than the degree of benefit in Contrave. And with Wegovy, they have done the questionnaires called control of eating questionnaires in GLP-1 treatment. And what it's showing is that cravings also get better. So we can't actually use the cravings conversation now to navigate which treatment for which patient. How are we going to update the next set of guidelines to determine which agent to pick? We're using outcomes. So for example, Wegovy is the only molecule that has shown cardiovascular reduction in the SELECT mm-hmm. trial in patients with obesity. We've had lots of cardiovascular outcome trials in diabetes, and they, you know, all the SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1s have shown great benefit, but we've never seen it in people without obesity who are, without diabetes, who are just getting on obesity treatment outside of bariatric surgery. So now really the conversation is this patient with obesity and cardiovascular disease, you know, they should be on semaglutide because that's the one that's shown to show cardiovascular benefit. We're going to have the same conversation with NASH. We're going to have the same conversation with sleep apnea and PCOS. And so I think that's really where the conversation is going. It's what is the outcome that we're looking for and which agent is best suited to treat that outcome.
That's, you read my mind, because my next question is, okay, so we've lost 15% weight, and that's great for patients, right? It's great for their self-esteem and how they feel, and they can exercise. That's the top of the house mm-hmm. and eat better. Mm-hmm. But what about clinical outcomes? So you're looking at cardiovascular health. What about diabetes? Because we were taught that if you lose 10% of your weight, you can go from pre-diabetes into remission, or you can mm-hmm. get into remission. Like, have you noticed that as well? Is there any mm-hmm. data on that?
Absolutely. So all of the initial placebo-controlled trials on all of these agents actually look at diabetes, decreasing diabetes progression. So going from pre-diabetes to normal glycemia. And of course, the GLP-1 receptor agonists do the best at that because of their direct effect on insulin sensitivity. In the SCALE trial, that was specifically looking at Saxenda or liraglutide and the patients with pre-diabetes. And I can't remember off the top of my head, but I want to say it's about 80 to 90% of patients go to normal glycemia. You'd kind of expect that. This is a diabetes mm-hmm. treatment mm-hmm. at the end of the day. Right. But if we can move the needle on diabetes, that's incredible. Like, we imagine the healthcare ecosystem if we were able to reduce diabetes by even 2% in the Canadian population. Like, that would be incredible. So we are seeing all, you know, the reason I got into this area is because for the first time I was taking medications away from people. As an endocrinologist, like, I was just like, prescribe this, then the statin, then the this, then the ACE inhibitor, you know, and it's just like, which one are you going to be on next? But
when does that happen?
Yeah, exactly. Imagine, like, first of all, how much that changes a patient's life to be able to move their body and do all these things they haven't been able to do. But then to be able to deprescribe because your treatment worked and you actually got down to the root cause, it's kind of an incredible thing. So I do think we're moving, you know, for the first time, we're going to move the needle on fatty liver, which is now called metabolically right. associated yep. steatosis, right? So it's a whole.
I learned that a couple of days ago. I'm like, what does this mean? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we don't call it NASH. No. We don't call it fatty liver. We call it MASH or MASLD.
Yeah.
But that's because, like, what? We actually have treatment for MASH? That's yeah. never happened. That was starting to be the number one cause of liver transplant. Imagine moving the needle on that, right? So I think it's exciting. It's super exciting. And cardiovascular disease is just the tip of the iceberg, honestly.
So let's talk about two more things then in that case, because obviously it's very exciting. It's going to move the needle. There's diseases which are a huge burden on the healthcare system, on patients' quality of life. But how come it's not covered?
Yeah.
That's my question. It's covered if you have private insurance. And even then, it's you have to go through some hooks. But is there any talk about coverage in any of the provinces? Maybe this is not a question for you. I don't know how involved you are, but I'm just curious what you know about mm-hmm. this.
Yeah, I'm actually super involved because to me, this is from a career perspective, if I can open up access, then I've done more than, you know, I can do on a one-to-one basis for my individual patient. And so I'm part of the patient access committees and CADTH applications, and it is not for a lack of effort. So every single, whether it was Wegovy or Contrave, have applied to CADTH for provincial reimbursement, and they've always been denied. And they've always been denied, you know, largely, honestly, because of inherent stigma and bias. There's a lot of people that still think that obesity is a lifestyle problem. They just need to eat less. And, you know, they feel like, you know, the medications, you need to be on them long term. And that's ridiculous because they don't understand that obesity is a chronic disease itself. There's also this big question around health economics. So the reality of the situation is that right now, the outcome data that we have is not showing huge benefit with outcomes because our drugs weren't powerful enough and the medications are expensive. So the government is not yet ready to put their foot forward to say, you know, potentially up to 60% of the Canadian adult population may need these medications. First problem. Right. Second problem, they're expensive. Third problem, the outcomes have not yet shown morbidity and mortality benefit, but the SELECT trial changed that. So, you know, if we're ever going to move the needle, we need to make the drugs cheaper and the pharmaceutical companies need to get on board with that sort of advocacy. If we're going to start proving mortality benefit, I don't think we're going to have much of a choice from a government perspective, because now it's like very point blank in your face that the, you know, for your population, this is going to, we know exactly what it's going to do. And we know exactly how much money per person it's going to save by investing so much into the population. I'll be honest, the last 5 years, the conversation has changed. 5 years ago, we didn't have a seat at the table. There was no conversation. COVID happened. The greatest predictor of severe COVID in Canada was obesity. And so that was an interesting change in conversation, because then we got a seat at the table noticing that our population isn't looking so healthy and obesity is playing a huge role here. So the conversation is slowly changing. The newer medications are studying the medications in a way to improve access. And so that's where the SELECT trial, we didn't talk about tirzepatide or the GLP-1 GIP dual agonist. In Canada, it's been approved for diabetes. It's called Mounjaro. Mm-hmm. It's not approved at all for obesity yet. It was just approved in the US. It's called Zepbound. It's this ridiculous name, but Mounjaro or tirzepatide, the average weight reduction is 22%. Wow. So it's just showing us that like our treatments are more effective, and they're doing a cardiovascular outcome trial for tirzepatide. So I don't know. I think I'm hopeful that the conversation is going to change, but I think everybody has a responsibility here. And I think the pharmaceutical companies have responsibility in pricing, because we can't bankrupt, you know, the Canadian
government. Yeah.
It's a money conversation, and it has to make sense at the end of the day.
Yeah. I was going to ask about Mounjaro, because I had a drug rep who came 2 weeks ago talking about it. So I'm glad you mentioned it as well. Mm-hmm. So last question about the drugs, and I want to talk a bit about your weight management program, because it's quite mm-hmm. interesting as well. But so side effects, right? Yeah. So what are the things you worried about? I mean, I know that Europe is talking about mental health issues, but what looking at the data, what are you really worried about in terms of side effects? Or are you worried about something specific?
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting, because if you prescribe these medications properly, I'm actually not very worried about very much. I'm worried about two things: inappropriate prescribing. If you don't titrate slowly enough, if you don't educate patients on what to look out for and how to self-titrate, that's the biggest, I think, way to navigate the side effects, the GI side effects that you typically get at the beginning. It's by slow titration. Most of the time, the scripts are written, just ramp up every, you know, if it's semaglutide, every 4 weeks without even a conversation. And we're going to run into problems. So I think that most of the side effects are avoidable. You just need appropriate education and prescription awareness. The thing I'm worried about is the newer medications. At some point, we have to have a conversation to say, you know, is 20% weight reduction even a good thing? Like, does everyone need 20% weight? Right. And the answer is no, because at the end of the day, when you lose weight, you're losing lean muscle mass and fat mass. And granted, most of it's fat mass, you know, the data with the DEXA scans show about 75% fat mass, 25% lean muscle mass. So it's still worth it. The benefits still outweigh the risks in the average person, even though you're losing lean muscle mass. But at 25% weight reduction in somebody who may not be getting education on eating enough protein, is elderly, or not doing any resistance training, you know, we may start running into sarcopenia and actually making patients weaker and increasing frailty and increasing fracture risk. And there are lots of things that if you do this treatment without understanding the downstream effects, we can start running into problems. And so, you know, there's a lot of patients who are so desperate, and they're a vulnerable population, and they're seeking treatment in ways that are whatever they have to do, right? They're going to online, you know, script mills, and we're seeing all these things kind of come out. They've never had a conversation. They have a text message conversation with someone and they have a prescription. That is so scary because, like I said, the roof of the house, that's the roof for a reason. You can't have a house without a roof. And so if you're not talking about the behavioral piece and the nutritional therapy, you will struggle. And honestly, people don't stay on medications because they don't understand that this is a chronic disease. They stop the medication, they regain 100% fat. You don't regain muscle mass. And so every time we do that and we don't assist our patients properly, we're going to leave them in a worse place than when they started. And that's not good.
Yeah, I make sure I talk to them about the muscle mass issue. And, and again, I love the fact that it's part of the house. You have to have the exercise somehow for that reason. But that's very interesting. So that's great. I mean, I have 10,000 questions. We have limited time. So let's move on to what you're doing. And let's talk about the weight management program that you're running. So it's called the MWM Weight Management Program. How old is it?
Yeah, so it's pretty brand new. So myself and Dr. David Macklin, he's a GP psychotherapist. So he was the author of the behavioral chapter of the clinical practice guidelines. And I was one of the co-authors of the assessment chapter. So we essentially understand sort of the obesity landscape in Canada pretty well, but we understand the huge lack of access. And there's a lack of access for many different reasons. There's a lot of healthcare providers, dietitians, and doctors that want to do this work, but don't feel confident because they don't have the training. So we're both sort of were part of this mentorship program where we had all these mentees, these family doctors and specialists come into our practice and shadow us, and they would get so excited and they get so passionate and they really want to do this work. And then they go back to their clinical practice and literally won't have a way to do it because there's no billing codes and it's not lucrative. Right. And how do I actually like put food on the table with this kind of treatment? It's very difficult. So we understood that component of it. And so we built a training program that focuses on psychotherapy for weight management and medical therapy, because those are the two pillars that for the average patient with obesity would be what is needed. And the behavioral therapy part is the least effectively done. The medication part is improving, but we don't have the behavioral therapy. And the behavioral therapy is dealing with the emotional eating, talking about cravings. How do I deal with nighttime eating, binge eating, all of those pieces? So we've trained all of our healthcare providers specifically on CBT and behavioral therapy. And we created a program that is hopefully eventually going to be national. Currently, we're in 4 different provinces across Canada. It's all done virtually. It's a dietitian doctor team that sees the patient every 2 weeks for 6 months. So it's intensive. And we know that the first 6 months are predictive of future success because that's when you gather all the tools in the toolbox. So we built this, it's called the Medical Weight Management Center of Canada, MWMCC. And patients can self-enroll. There is a cost to the program because it's run by dietitians mainly. If you have health coverage that covers dietitian support, then we are able to get some funding, sort of covering some of the costs that way, but there's still a cost. And that's the largest barrier to any obesity treatment, is that at this point, we don't have any provincial funding. But David and I, our big sort of point of starting the MWM program was, one, we need to improve access now. Like, it is completely ridiculous that we have these globally recognized guidelines and we don't have a way to deliver the care effectively in our practice. That is not okay. It is not okay because we can do it. And David and I do it every day. So that means everyone else can do it. We just haven't set the system up to be successful. And so our idea is, let's build it. Let's see what happens. We collect a ton of data. We want to prove that if we do it properly, this is how much it costs. It doesn't cost that much, actually. This is how much it costs for training. The training is scalable. Everything is done virtually. So this is a scalable conversation. And we hope to take it to the government to say, like, here it is. You know, there isn't a question of how we're going to do it. How much is it going to cost? Does it make sense? Because we want to put it all on paper to sort of say, here it is. You know, let's get it out there for our patients, in the same way that if you're diagnosed with diabetes, you can see a dietitian through a diabetes education center. There is no reason why we can't facilitate the same type of resources for people with obesity, knowing that were preventing the diabetes in the first place and all those downstream effects. So that was sort of the impetus to the MWM program. We've launched about 6.5 months ago. So we just got our first cohort of people that have passed the 6-month program. And so it's been so incredible, honestly, to look at the data that we've been able to collect. I'll give you just like a short example of, yes, we're collecting all the stuff, the metabolic stuff, the control of eating questionnaire, the quality of life questionnaires, like all the things that you would typically expect in the randomized clinical trials that they collect. But we wanted to do things in a little bit because we can, you know, let's do it a little bit differently. And we measured, we didn't find a standardized way to measure self-efficacy. And we know that in any behavioral program, self-efficacy is predictive. If somebody feels confident in their ability to manage their disease long-term, they will likely be more successful at doing it. And so we measured self-efficacy by asking these questions, these standardized questions, every single visit. And, you know, spoiler alert, obviously self-efficacy improves when you're in a CBT-focused behavioral program. It increased by like 135%. Like it was just an incredible rise. But I'll share two things. One is that we had a patient actually gain weight in our program, but she said that this is the best thing she's ever done. And I was like, that to me is the definition of success in a weight management program, because people think that weight management or obesity treatment is about weight loss, and it's actually not. It's about the roof of the house. And so you can do a lot of different things to lose weight. It does not mean you're healthier. But if we can have you show up, be doing more than you ever did before, have more control over your eating, and feel confident about your ability to manage your disease long term, to me, that is far, far, far more effective of a treatment than 5, 10, 15% weight loss. So that was a really interesting outcome. And the other interesting thing that we're starting to see is people don't stop their medications. When you agree and accept that this is a chronic disease, you know what this medication is doing for you, and you feel the symptom benefit. The key with medications is most of the weight loss is in the first 6 months. So when do people stop the medication? When they stop losing weight, right? Obviously, this is for weight loss. So I'm going to be taking it. And when I stop losing weight, I'm going to stop the medication, because it's not for weight loss. It's for obesity. And if you understand that obesity is about appetite regulation and craving control and all of those pieces, then you'll understand that this is, even though you're not losing weight, you still need to be on treatment, because otherwise all those pathologies will come back. And our patients know that. And so we're seeing, like, we call it stay time. And we ask them every single time, you know, if they're going to stop it, why, so on. And we're collecting the data around that. But I just think, like, you can have great medications, but if nobody's going to take them properly, there's no point. Or if they're going to have downstream effects because they don't do the other stuff, also no point. And so those are the two biggest things that we're sort of starting to see. So hopefully the MWM program is going to be available to all Canadians by the end of 2024. That's the goal. And we're pretty close to actually getting there. So I do think we'll be able to achieve it. We're going to be publishing a lot on the program, because we want to get advice and we want to see kind of feedback on the program. And we want to make sure that we're doing what's right for people with obesity. And also for healthcare providers, because at the end of the day, we built this to make it easier for people to treat this disease properly. But we just need to make sure that we're doing the right thing.
So, and again, just going back to this paradigm shift, I mean, you're so correct that you can have a slightly overweight person who's in much better shape than a very thin person, because you know, they're exercising, they're eating well. So that's great that you mentioned that. And that's really an interesting story, and I'm glad to hear it. And is the program, once it opens up, is it self-referred? Or let's say you have a patient who's interested, do you have to refer them, or do they refer themselves? How does it usually work?
Yeah, so definitely you don't have to do anything as a healthcare provider. A patient can go on to the website mwmcc.ca and self-enroll. If they want to talk to one of our docs before enrolling, because I can understand going through another commitment and the financial piece of it. So you can talk to one of our doctors for free, just to sort of say, is this right for me? What's the conversation I'm going to be having? So you can sort of click on the program overview call or free call. to have a conversation about it. So the patient doesn't act, the physician doesn't actually need to refer. One of the things that we did build into the program is feedback back to the primary care doctor. Because this is a chronic disease and this program is 6 to 12 months, we offer ongoing maintenance support, but it's very difficult to pay out of pocket long-term. So the idea is we're here if you need us. You can drop in and out of the program forever. Once you're a patient of ours, you're always a patient of ours. But your family doctor's got this. You know, we are just trying to set you up with all the ancillary resources you need to do this. But from a long-term perspective, we send notes back to primary care. We give follow-up recommendations. We talk about all the modulators, stress, sleep, ADHD, mental health. We do all the screening tests for patients and send the primary care doctor that information. I hope that's a good thing. You know, what I didn't want to do, there's a fine line between inundating, you know, primary care docs who are already so busy, but we're trying to take the burden away to sort of say, let's do the treatment, the hands-on treatment, and then, you know, give the patient back to your care to sort of say, you know, here are the things that we've done. Here's the things to continue to do, but hopefully we're making people's lives easier because we're treating so many of the comorbidities.
As a primary care physician, I appreciate that you're sending those notes, because sometimes, you know, you see a patient, it's like, what did they do?
Exactly.
I don't know what to do. I'm not sure, but I see where the burden is, but I actually appreciate having those notes. And listen, I have so many questions, but we have limited time, and I really appreciate your time. And I really wish you good luck with this initiative. It's great that Canada's leading on this. I had no idea, actually. It's amazing today. And thank you for taking the time to talk about this to our audience today.
For sure. Thanks for having me.